Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this encore edition of Bina, our guest is musician, actress, and writer Carrie Brownstein, who appeared in 2015 to discuss her memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. She was joined in conversation by writer, editor, and publisher Dave Eggers. And now join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Carrie Brownstein and Dave Eggers.
It is a true honor to introduce Carrie Brownstein, musician, writer, actor, and most recently, marriage officiant. Widely known first as the guitarist and vocalist for Slater Kinney and later as a creator, writer, and co-star of the Emmy-nominated Peabody Award-winning Portlandia. Carrie's writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Believer, and Slate, and in numerous anthologies on music and culture. She was named one of the top female electric guitarists, and in 2006 earned a spot on Rolling Stone's list of the 25 most underrated guitarists of all time. Last year, when Carrie was here to interview Kim Gordon, I vowed to have her back, and I'm so glad we are able to do that tonight. In her beautifully written memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, Carrie offers a candid, funny, and deeply personal look at making a life and finding yourself in music. Before Carrie Brownstein was a music icon, she was a fan just like all of us, and she has never forgotten the power and mystery of live performance from that side of the stage. Her book is intimate, revealing, accessible, honest, and heartfelt, and tells the story of a young woman, a born performer and an outsider, who ultimately finds her true calling through hard work, courage, and the intoxicating power of rock and roll. Carrie is joined tonight by Dave Eggers, who told me to introduce him by saying he's a local writer, and also co-founder of 826 National and Scholar Match. So please join me to welcome Carrie Brownstein and Dave Eggers.
Hello. Thanks for coming. I'm happy to be back here. I think I was here earlier this year. I think it was this year, interviewing Kim Gordon. And now I'm here to interview you.
You took over already, Carrie. Thanks for coming. This is very exciting. The last time we saw each other, you actually did a benefit for 826 Valencia, you and Fred. Do you remember this?
Of course I remember it.
And you performed with a bunch of our students. And what did they did the 826 Landia?
Yes.
They performed a kind of a version. They wrote versions of your skits.
And I was wearing a diaper.
That's true.
I can't believe that's what I remember, but I like how you remember all the other things because I left there thinking I just wore a diaper in front of a lot of people.
So, anyway... that wasn't part of our, but thank you for doing that.
It was my pleasure.
To wear a diaper at the St. Regis Hotel in, and a very fancy benefit. All right, let's talk about this book. How many of you have already read it? Oh, all right, you could clap. All right, how great is this book, right? Let's publicly congratulate you. This is incredibly hard to do what you did, and you wrote a lot of it here in San Francisco. You were recording No Cities to Love and writing this book. And how incredibly difficult and arduous was that? It's not as fun as you think it's going to be, right? Writing a book. It's an incredible pain in the ass.
I feel like it's zero fun. The fun happens when now, I guess. Like now is fun, but writing it was not that fun. It was really difficult. I had a lot of it already written when we began recording No Cities to Love, and we recorded it here in San Francisco at Tiny Telephone, which is John Vanderslice's studio, and we stayed all together in a house. Airbnb, which I know, please. I knew someone was going to boo. I almost booed for you before, just just to avoid the one person booing, I read the New York Times article. I stayed in the mission. I know. It's messed up. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm just telling a story. Let's have a soundtrack of booing behind me, just in case I say anything that is sensitive. So we were staying in an Airbnb in this awesome neighborhood, the Mission. It's like the coolest, whitest neighborhood in San Francisco. And in the mornings before we went to record, I would go to a coffee shop and I would work on this book. One thing that enabled me to be a better writer is that I'm a morning person. It also made it really difficult to be someone that was in a rock band for many years because I like to go to bed around 10 and get up at 6 or, you know, 10:30. Sometimes 9, I don't know. Anyway, so it allowed me to wake up early and write. And what was interesting was that reimmersing myself in the world of Slater Kinney really helped fill in some of the details. I had these chapters written and these sections written about the band, and then I kind of felt like I was exhuming this corpse. Like, all of a sudden, we were in the band again. And when I started the book, I was writing about it in a way of, you know, thinking, well, this is only in the past. So it was really interesting to fill in parts of the book once we started up again.
Well, did the band getting back together serve as one of the catalysts for writing the book? Because it's not suspenseful. We know the band got back together. So, but sometimes to take on a book, but a memoir in particular, you need to know the beginning and end, I think, to get it started, because life keeps going. You have to have that end point. When you were undertaking it, did you know already, was it undertaken before the band planned to get back together? Or
it was, and the end was that last, was the last show, and in 2006 on stage in Portland. And yeah, that was the original end. And then all of a sudden, I had this new end, and that actually changed a lot of the earlier content in the book, because I felt like, I don't know, it just changed, it changed the tone of it a little bit, and I went back and made some changes. But yeah, that was very strange, but also a relief. And I didn't get the band back together, so I had a better ending.
That's a good idea.
But it did allow me to have a pretty great epilogue for the book.
Well, let's start at the beginning, though. You describe your childhood beautifully here, and it has a very direct through line, I think, to who you became as a performer. You talk about sort of this, you put on a lot of shows at home, and
yeah, this was like my one-woman show. I was doing like a lot of hats, and I really experienced the world through performance. I had a fairly chaotic childhood in some ways. I was in a family where I didn't feel seen a lot of the time because both my parents were kind of experiencing their own forms of confusion and anxiety and loss of self or not knowing who they were. So it's hard to pay attention, I think, when you're experiencing that. So one way that I would make sense of that chaos at home was to perform. It's sort of the way I could control a situation. A lot of things felt out of control. And, you know, putting on a show, whether it's a play or dancing, ballet, which I never did formally, but I did informally a lot, was a way of creating structure and also kind of, you know, taking the attention away from this encroaching sadness onto something that hopefully would be entertaining. So the early parts of the book are a lot of descriptions of many, many performances.
Including the Little D Duran Duran cover band that you had.
Yeah, cover band is a generous term because we weren't playing any instruments, but we were strumming scrap wood that we had borrowed from our parents' garage.
Strumming scrap wood. I just want to underline that.
Strumming away on a scrap wood that we had painted and nailed together to look kind of like guitars. Luckily in the 80s, guitars basically just, you know, they were weird shapes. They were just like a triangle, you know, or like a keytar was popular, and that's just a rectangle, and then you just paint it with house paint, so every instrument was gray, and then we just hung out on our parents, my neighbor's deck, and we just played along to, we just lip synced. It wasn't. Cover band again. It was a lip sync band, but I was the lead singer, even though everyone else was just air guitaring or air keyboarding. I was singing over the music because you know you can if you're in charge. And so I was basically the neighborhood impresario in a lot of these events. And like if my parents had people over, you know, and it would be time for bed, I would ask if I could sing an Eagles song. And, you know, songs about cocaine are really appropriate to sing. You know, Life in the Fast Lane is, you know, a common experience for a suburban child.
That sounds totally healthy. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of, especially somebody that grows up to be the musician that you became might be inclined to fib about their first concert and say it was Muddy Waters or, I don't know, Sonic Youth. I don't know, somebody impressive. And your first concert was?
Madonna.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that would be amazing if I had the wherewithal to say that I saw Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Or like Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
I think Madonna, I have to say, I feel like that's a fairly impressive first concert.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, I may have stumbled into a Raffi show before that. But for the record, it was Madonna. I mean, Raffi was just happening in the background of a fair, maybe. But it was 1985, and Madonna's Like a Virgin came out, and I mean that really caught the nation by storm. I sound like at
well
the beginning of a music documentary.
Yeah.
And she started her Virgin tour. It was literally her first tour outside of New York, and her first night was in Seattle, and she played three shows at a 3,000 capacity theater called the Paramount. Mm. And I went the first night, and the Beastie Boys opened. Oh, we booed them. We booed them right off stage. We didn't know. They were just these young punks from New York with a lot of swagger, and hip hop was not super popular in Seattle at the time. And we wanted to see Madonna roll around in a wedding dress, and a wedding dress is what I asked my mom if I could wear to the show.
Her wedding dress.
Her wedding dress.
Yeah.
And she said no, which I think is the right decision.
I think she called it inappropriate, right?
Yeah, which it was really inappropriate. I also wanted to wear, Flashdance was popular at the time, too. I was only in fifth grade, so, you know, Flashdance is a sophisticated film.
And has many layers.
And there's also Jennifer Beals and you know, it's sexual. And everyone wanted to wear these off-the-shoulder, she wears like an off-the-shoulder gray sweatshirt. And I wasn't allowed to do that, but I was allowed to wear, at the mall they sold Flashdance clothes with a shirt sewn in underneath to make it more appropriate. So it was like, it was literally like a baseball jersey underneath, like a 3/4 length sleeve underneath, and a sweatshirt off the shoulder above it. Wow. And I was allowed to wear that.
Yeah.
But instead, to the Madonna show, I wore a button-up with exotic fruits on it.
Mm. That's so good. All right, we have to jump ahead. First guitar.
First guitar was a cherry red Epiphone copy of a Fender Strat. Wow. That's right. Pretty cool. And a solid-state amplifier from Canada that I bought. It was the first thing I bought with my own money, which I think I had gone through a lot of phases. You know, like, I thought I was going to be a professional tennis player, and that didn't work out. And I just had other hobbies, I think, that my parents had invested in, and they were just like, no, like, you need to buy this on your own. And I am glad I did, because it made me sort of want to prove to them that I was going to stick with it. And I did.
And when you first started, did you have heroes, somebody that you were emulating? I know that you liked More Than a Feeling, so I'm assuming the guitarist for Boston was one of your...
Yeah.
No, but was there somebody that you were looking up to at that point?
By that point, so I bought my first guitar at 15, and I had finally started listening to punk and indie, and I listened to the Ramones and the Clash, and there were a lot of local bands. There was this guy named Jeremy Enoch who went to my high school. He later formed this band called Sunny Day Real Estate, and he... Before he was in Sunny Day, he was just like our hero, our guitar hero in school. So he was kind of my favorite. I think when you're young, often like you name check these people from bands, but really it's just some friend you have that you're like, I want to play like that. And I wanted to play like Jeremy, and he was the one that taught me chords.
I wondered if you could read a page from early on, which is sort of helps illustrate, I think, that period when you were first maybe forming your...
Going to the shows, that part?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. In 10th grade, a few of my friends were old enough to drive, and I started making my way out of the suburbs and into Seattle on the weekends. Some of the shows we saw were at big venues, like the Moore or the Paramount Theater, the Church, the Ramones, Sonic Youth, the Jesus and Mary Chain. But most of the time, we go to smaller places, like the Party Hall or OK Hotel, and we'd see Northwest-based bands like Tree People, Kill Sybil, Hammerbox, Engine Kid, Aspirin Feast, Galleon's Lap, Christ on a Crutch, and Positive Greed. How those are amazing names. Here I could get close to the players themselves. I could see how the drums worked with the guitars and bass. I could watch fingers move along the frets and feet stomp down on effects pedals. I saw the set list taped to the floor. And sometimes I was close enough to see the amp or pickup settings. I observed the nature of the bands, their internal interactions, their relationships to one another, as much as I listened. It seems obvious, but it was the first time I realized that music was playable, not just performable, that it had a process and a seed, a beginning, middle, and end. Everyone who plays music needs to have a moment that ignites and inspires them, calls them into the world of sound, and urges them to make it. And I suppose this form of witness could happen aurally. Perhaps it's as easy as hearing an Andy Gill riff or a Kim Gordon cadence and knowing intuitively how that all works. Then you form those sounds yourself with your own hands and your own voice. Or maybe you see it on a video in footage of a musician who finally translates and unlocks what you thought was a mystery. For me, however, I needed to be there. To see guitarists like Kim Warnick and Kurt Block of the Fastbacks, or Doug Marsh of Tree People play chords and leads, or Calvin Johnson and Heather Lewis from Beat Happening in the wholly relatable attire of a threadbare t-shirt, jean shorts, enact a weird nerd sexiness, strangely minimal, maximally perverse. I could watch them play songs that weren't coming out of thin air or from behind a curtain. I needed to press myself up against small stages, risking crushed toes, bruised sides, and the unpredictable undulation of the pit, just so I could get a glimpse of who I wanted to be.
That's pretty great, huh? Thank you. Thanks for reading that. The book articulates sort of the entry of somebody into this world, I think, better than anything I've ever read. It's just passage after passage like that. And I wondered if you could talk about sort of that transition from being at home, and you're living in Redmond, and you're in this, you know, suburban environment, and then auditioning for 7 Year Bitch, which is like a hilarious story. And how old were you when you did that?
I was 17.
You're 17.
Yeah.
So so much of what happens.
I was 18. Yeah. Yeah. But I was very young.
You were very young, and so how does somebody get? I don't know, the courage to do that at so young. And this is a band that, you know, already had a name for itself, and many people would be so intimidated, but you just called them on the phone, looked them up, tell the story.
No, I was liking, I was appreciating you telling it. I was like, oh, this sounds interesting.
Thank you.
You're listening to musician, actress, and writer Carrie Brownstein, who appeared in 2015 to discuss her memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. She was joined in conversation by writer, editor, and publisher Dave Eggers on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kaalw.org.
So when I first graduated high school, I went to a state school in the northern part of Washington, and I dropped out and had about a year before I was going to start at another state school down in Olympia. So I moved back home with my dad and my sister, and I felt very aimless. I had this time before I was going to go back to college, and there was a music weekly up in Seattle called The Rocket, and they had a musician wanted ads in the back, and I would read them and try to find people to play music with. And there was this ad that said, girl guitarist wanted, no winky solos. And I just thought, no winky solos, I can't play a solo at all. So I was like, I'm perfect for whoever this is. And yeah. I called, and the woman that answered was this woman, Elizabeth, who was the bass player in Seven Year Bitch. And I was shocked that this band that, you know, was on Sub Pop and had put out records was just advertising in the local paper. Tragically, their guitarist had died about 6 months to a year before. And I practiced their songs. I learned like two songs on a 7-inch, which is really hard because there's, you know, you can't just hit repeat or rewind every time the song ends. You put the needle back to the beginning, and I sat and learned the song. She didn't ask me to. I just thought, well, maybe she's going to want to jam, and I want to be prepared. And so I was living in the suburbs, and she lived in Seattle, and my outfit that I picked out to go there was an oversized Hanes t-shirt in white, one of my dad's vests, and it was so big on me, I described it as looking like saloon doors, and cut-off jean shorts. Did you just say, oh my God? I mean, okay, I get it, yes. Oh my God, I'm not even at the best part. I'm not even at the oh my God part, which is a Kelly Green J. Crew baseball cap. Just put that on backwards and get in your car and drive to the suburbs to meet like this super cool chick with like tattoos, and I opened the door and she's in all black. I was like, right, all black. I mean, that white shirt was just like a beautiful cloud, and I was like, oh, hello, thunderstorm. I am a big, giant, puffy cloud. And she offered me a beer, and I mean, I was only 18, and also, like, I'd only ever drink beer through a beer bong in high school. I was like, oh, like, you sip beer? I thought I just had to pound it. And I said, no, thank you, because also I was so scared to sit and have a beer in the afternoon in daylight. And we sat on the couch, and the singer, Selena, came over, and I knew I'd never got a chance to play. I knew I wasn't cool enough for these guys, and so I didn't get the job. But I did write them a letter, a pretty maudlin and histrionic letter that compared myself to a young John Frusciante from the Chili Peppers. Because the reason that they gave me for not getting the job was that I was too young and that they played a lot of bars and I wouldn't be old enough to get into the show. And I remembered that John Frusciante had been about 18 when he joined the Chili Peppers. So I tried to compare myself to him, even though at the time, you know, he was kind of a wunderkind on guitar, and I just knew a couple chords. And it didn't work. So anyway, that's my story of trying out for Seven Year Bitch.
Well, it has a nice ending later, maybe we'll get to, but I wanted to talk about Olympia. So not too long after that, Olympia had this sort of mythic status. You know, it was like the home of so many. It was, for the size of the the city. It had an incredible influence. And can you talk about sort of making that move and sort of moving into that kind of mecca and being kind of immediately, I think, immersed? I mean, you couldn't walk a block without meeting somebody in one of these, you know, iconic bands at the time. What was that like at that time? And what did Olympia mean when you were, when you first moved there?
Yeah, so Evergreen State College is where I applied and knew I was going to go for school, but most of the reason for wanting to be in Olympia was because of the music scene. And I had started to listen to, despite being sort of adjacent to this burgeoning Seattle scene, which was on you know, basically about to blow up, Olympia had really captured my attention. There were these labels there, K and Kill Rock Stars, and they were putting out these amazing compilations, bands like Enwound and Carp, but specifically bands like Bikini Kill and Heavens to Betsy. And these were some of the first bands that featured these, you know, female singers that sang unapologetically about the female experience and about subjects that had up until then sort of been taboo and hadn't really been included in the vernacular of punk music. These stories that as a young person I had yet to articulate, but I felt very recognized by these songs, and I think a lot of people did by these stories. So when I moved to Olympia, it was partly because I felt like these are my people, and they're everyone there is, sort of has the key to all the things that I hope dearly I can unlock in myself. And aside from going to college, you know, I felt like Olympia was my education and just immersing myself in this scene where it felt like almost everyone had a band or two bands or three bands, and each band had it sort of its own like strange logic to it, separate from sort of the logic of the rest of the bands in America. You know, they were these weird, I call them like slight amputations, like, you know, two people in a band or three drummers in a band or a bass player, no guitar. There was a band with seven guitars, you know, just these strange, you know, configurations that were very intriguing and so unique and innovative. And yeah, I could not have been more excited. And I sort of willed myself into that world and until I was a part of it.
And your first band was Excuse 17. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's how you met Heavens to Betsy. You guys toured together.
Yeah, I actually met Corin up in Bellingham where I was going to college.
Before?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. But you went to her show.
Yeah, I went to her show.
And so what's it like, you know, you saw her as a, you know, as a fan, and then suddenly you're touring with her, I don't know, a few years later. Everything happened so quickly, it seemed like, and so you were so young. And what, I don't know, I guess there's something about Olympia, reading about it, especially the way that you, you know, evoke it. It's like this incredibly concentrated scene where people are supporting each other. And you find this a lot in artist communities where a lot of bands or a lot of artists will come up together, and if they're all mutually supportive in a way and sort of wanting the same thing and kind of saying, I'll help you, I'll record on your album, and you help. Was it that kind of an atmosphere at that time where you felt part of something, that where you have the right place, the right people, the right time, and it can have an outsized influence? Did you know that that was going on when you were part of it?
I mean, you sort of sensed that, although I think part of what made it so fertile was that we weren't really able to estimate the influence. And because of that, I think a lot of the energy was sort of incubating and percolating and insular and without sort of an ear or eye to what was happening in the mainstream or even what was happening, you know, in LA or New York. And I think because of that, you know, there was this uniqueness and this ferocity. And I think that, you know, sometimes I think when you're considering, you know, how other people are looking at you or, you know, estimating who you are, that can start to affect the work itself. And there was actually sort of a media blackout because there was specifically Bikini Kill and some of the early Riot Grrrl bands, the mainstream media wrote about them in a very unsophisticated way, and it was, you know, to say the least. And so people had decided, well, we're not going to talk to press. Yeah. And that just created, you know, this perimeter around the city that, so every people came to us, you know, I mean, basement shows with Elliot Smith or Jawbreaker, who was at the time a big band, they would come, they would be playing these big shows in San Francisco or Seattle, and then they would come to Olympia and play a basement show. Stereolab, Beck, you know, these people were playing tiny places in Olympia because it was like one of the unofficial mottos of Olympia is like, it's the water, but it did kind of feel like people sort of came to the city to kind of drink the water, to kind of come in and like sort of dip their toe into this creative environment, and Beck recorded an album there, and people would just kind of come and stay in this very unusual way that I think at the time we didn't even really realize was unusual. But, you know, when most bands tour, you don't go to a city, you don't go to Iowa City, you don't go to Topeka and spend 3 or 4 days there. I mean, perhaps you do, but a lot of times you don't, and I think we just didn't, we didn't really realize how special it was. I mean, I think, you know, we were inspired, and I think it was a very, you know, it was amazing, and at, but it felt very normal to us in such a strange way, because people would form a band on Monday, or someone would come into town, like Ian Svenonius from Nation of Ulysses or Makeup, and, you know, record something with Calvin at Deb Narcotic, and they would maybe, that band would decide to play a show on a Wednesday, and by Friday they would have a, you know, an album recorded or a 7-inch, and yeah, I mean, it was just, it was a strange factory with very unique galvanic output, I guess. It was, yeah, I, when looking back on it, it's really bizarre that it ever happened.
And well, speaking of combining different bands, so you're in Excuse 17, Corin's in Heavens to Betsy, and talk about how these two bands left those two bands and created Sleater-Kinney. The first time you thought that that might have been something real, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, well, everyone had what we would call at the time side projects. Yeah. You know, so Corin and then Becca, who I was in Excuse 17 with, they had a band called Heartless Martin. You know, everyone just had multiple bands. So
side project names are awesome. They
yeah.
always are.
Heartless yeah. Martin, yeah, it was a great. There was an apartment building called The Martin, and it was a testimony to, you know, heartbreak at The Martin. Anyway, it was like such these very self-referential insider baseball titles or monikers. And so Corin and I, with Sleater-Kinney, was going to essentially be a side project to these other bands. And I just remember coming home one day and on my answering machine, Corin had left a message that said, I guess we need a name for this. Let's call it Sleater-Kinney. And people made fun of us because, yeah, it was just the name of a road and other people were going to name their bands. They started naming off other roads in Olympia that they were going to name their bands. And you know, we were like, okay, it's not a big deal. Well, this is just a project band. We're never going to do that much. But then we went to Australia, and we formed the band.
Well, you said you went to the other side of the world to create your sound. And why Australia?
Well, Corin had just graduated, and actually, my dad asked me that same question because I think he was like, I thought you were studying when you were over there. And this was after he read the book. This was like his main concern. My dad's in the book a lot. This was literally his main concern. And he had a question about whether we were sharing a credit card at the time or not, as if he was going to go back through a file cabinet and like look up all my charges from that time. But
that's
I
great.
Love parents like that.
That's
he was
such a dad
he
thing.
He only
that's
had
so
fiduciary
great.
concerns. Yeah. I was like, okay. Anyway, you know, I think part of it was, it's interesting that we were talking about the insularity and the sort of inclusive but also very exclusive nature of Olympia. There's also something very stifling about a community that, as I describe in the book, is kind of in dialogue with itself and is sort of unwilling to have a dialogue with anything outside of its own walls. It can create something very fiery and that you can also self-immolate under those circumstances. So I think Corin and I consciously but also subconsciously knew we had to remove ourselves from this context, which had started to feel sort of less than inspiring for us in terms of what we wanted to do as a band. And it felt like there was kind of a dictionary within Olympia, and there was only a certain set of words. Mm. And we went to Australia so, you know, we could make up our own. And that's when we came up with the sound of Sleater-Kinney.
I thought, you know, people have tried to describe your sound for so long, and I think that you did it better than anybody. So I wondered if you could just read this passage.
Sure. Corn was louder than me, so her vocal was the lead by default. But we never really considered one a background part to the other. It was a conversation we were having. She had her perspective and I had mine. Or I was emphasizing her point, retelling it even as I was singing along with her. And our guitars did the same thing, augmenting and counteracting each other. We would get to the chorus, and intuitively you'd think, this is the time for us all to sing together, that there should be a cohesion, but instead we would split apart. It was almost an anti-chorus. We weren't trying to form a solidarity with anyone but ourselves. Could you sing along to Sleater-Kinney? Sometimes, but we'd just as likely shout over you. And good luck trying to sing along with Corin. Trust me, I know. It's nearly impossible. As a listener, you have to decide what to follow in the song, which vocal, which guitar. This way of writing and of singing was something we tacitly understood. We'd never discussed it. We never mentioned counter melodies. We didn't want to sing harmonies. Our songs weren't pretty, nor was our style of singing. It sounded scarier to not sing together, rarely allowing the listener to settle into the music. Everything inside the songs was constantly on the verge of breaking apart. Corin's voice, the narrative, the guitars, so few moments provided any respite at all. If we did sing together on the chorus, it was only after a strange, uncomfortable verse. Yet the result was forceful. It sounded like a tightly bound entity, fragments clinging to each other for dear life. If you pulled one thing apart, it wouldn't even sound like a real song. It was a junkyard come to life.
We were just talking back there. You were saying that sometimes you'll be at a restaurant and you'll, or a bar, and you'll hear a Sleater-Kinney song coming. Come on, what was your reaction?
I think, what is this racket? First of all, Sleater-Kinney is not a band that people will usually play at restaurants.
Yeah.
For a reason, it's not settled music, and it doesn't make people feel settled, and it's not really background music.
Yeah.
I've realized, and I, because of that, I don't. This is true. I don't recognize it. Like I remember being at a hair salon and hearing this really fast song, and I just thought, wow, this is a really disruptive thing for you guys to be playing while I'm sitting here trying to relax and get my hair cut. And then I realized it was Dig Me Out. And, but it has a velocity to it, and it's scary. And it's unrecognizable from, I only recognize it from the inside, I guess. Like, I recognize those songs through playing them, but when I'm hearing them back, I'm unsure of how fearsome they are. They're very intense.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is musician, actress, and writer Keri Brownstein, who appeared in 2015 to discuss her memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. She was joined in conversation by writer, editor, and publisher Dave Eggers. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, you say, I can listen to soft songs, but I can't play them. And does that have something to do with the performance element to it? because as a live band, you know, you can't experience Slater Kinney without seeing you live, I think. I mean, I think it's just a whole different level. And when did you know that you were a great live band? And sort of, can you talk about the relationship and what you felt when you first saw, I don't know, your first full concert where you were really clicking on all cylinders?
I honestly feel like we didn't become a great live band until The Woods. Like, that to me...
Come on!
I'm serious. For us, I mean, you can disagree, but from the inside, that's how it felt to me. I mean, I think that I know we played some good, maybe great shows before then, but that to me is when everything really came together. Was when, and I write a lot in the book about going on this tour with Pearl Jam, opening for them after One Beat, and really having to prove ourselves again after years of headlining our own shows and playing to crowds that really knew us and could kind of, you know, keep us moving along, and we could feed off their energy. And then all of a sudden we were playing to people that were very ambivalent towards us. Mm. And we had to earn, you know, even the slightest glance from them. And my goal was often to get them to stop eating hot dogs and look at us. And that would be my only goal. We started to tune them out and look and listen to each other, and we realized, well, they don't know any of our songs, so we don't necessarily have to play our songs. We can start deconstructing them. And that's when we started to improvise and jam on stage, and I think that's what made us a better live band. So I'm not saying I think we were good before that, but I think that's when, for us, it really came together. And I thought the tour for The Woods and for No Cities were probably, to me, my favorite shows.
Well, if you can backtrack and talk about, you had very passionate fans early on, and you were a fan a few years before, so it was a pretty quick turn when suddenly, you know, you had a sound that sounded unlike anybody else. And can you remember the first time you saw somebody singing along, and sort of the first time you felt like you were playing to audiences that had driven from far and wide to see you, and what was that like?
Yeah, I remember.
Especially you're still 19 years old or something like that.
Right, yeah, I was in my 20s by then. I remember a tour where I do remember the phenomenon of people starting to follow us, you know, along the Eastern Seaboard, especially, you know, because the shows are closer together, the cities are closer together. And there was a group of kids that had attached a set of prosthetic breasts to the front of their car. And so there it was, the breast car. There was like the boob car right at the venue, and we knew they were there. And, you know, and so there was those guys, and then there were fans. There was these two guys, and we just called one Sideshow Bob. You know, I mean, but those were things that we looked forward to every night. Just these, you know, there's Sideshow Bob, there's the boob car, and there's the people coming to see us. And that was really exciting, just to think that, because that's the kind of thing that I would do. I would drive from Seattle when I was a kid to Portland. And, you know, I had friends that would drive to San Francisco for a night from Seattle to see a band play. I mean, that kind of dedication didn't seem foreign to me. Like, I understood, you know, feeling like sound was a beacon that I would just kind of follow and show up and experience it and not regret anything, you know, foregoing sleep and everything else. So, yeah, I guess I definitely remember people would bring us peaches. There was some tours where people would bring us peaches on the East Coast. I guess I remember all the kind of the oddities, you know, more so than, you know, a specific someone singing along, or I don't know.
Peaches.
Or a girl with a... there was a lot of interpretations, I think, of Riot Girl in particular involved a lot of reclamation. Mm. And there was a girl that used a tampon as a hairpiece. And I just thought, no. Yeah, it was intense.
Well, after Slater Kinney had been playing for a while, can you just read this paragraph where you re-encounter Elizabeth Davis from 7 Year Bitch?
Yeah.
And I think it's such a nice sort of closing of that circle.
Okay. During the next few months, I occasionally ran into Elizabeth at Seattle shows and music festivals like 107.7's Enfest. She was always kind to me, but I had clearly become a pest. Later, when I knew what it felt like to carry the weight of your fans' aspirations, I would remember the way Elizabeth looked at me after I'd sent the letter. A look of pity, distrust, and weariness. There's a gulf of misunderstanding between musicians and their fans, and often so much desperation that the musician can't possibly assuage, rectify, or heal. You feel helpless and you feel guilty. With Sleater-Kinney fans, I tried to be generous, but I soon grew uneasy. For a long while, I could share nothing more than the music itself. I think I was too scared to be open with the fans because I knew how bottomless their need could be. How could I help if I was just like them? I was afraid I might not be able to lessen their pain or live up to their ideals. I would be revealed as a fraud, unworthy and insubstantial. The disconnect between who I was on and off stage would be so pronounced as to be jarring. Me, so small, so unqualified. In the early years of Sleater-Kinney, we played at Seattle's Crocodile Cafe. Elizabeth was at the show. By then, Seven Year Bitch had broken up. She came up to me, complimented my guitar playing, and told me she loved the band. Elizabeth didn't recognize me as the girl who had gone over to her house that day or written her an overly earnest tell-all letter. I was relieved that music had done exactly what I had always wanted it to do, which was turn me into someone else.
All right, let's go to another photo. Tell us about this photo.
You know what? There is a picture of Paul Stanley backstage, too.
Yeah. He did an event here, I guess, yeah.
Wow, okay, so this inside this magazine is the first sort of big article about Sleater-Kinney ever written. I think this is 1996, so I'm 22. And I think they were each on the cover of Spin, all four members of KISS. And inside this magazine, before the internet, you weren't necessarily privy to things before they came out, and the writer had outed me and Corin as having dated, which we had never told our parents. So my dad saw this magazine before I saw it, and called me and asked if I had something to tell him. It was actually a pretty terrible situation. I definitely would have wanted to be able to tell my parents myself and not have Spin magazine tell them for me. But sometimes you don't get that opportunity. So thank you, Spin, and Paul Stanley.
Paul Stanley. You can't implicate Paul Stanley. He's innocent in this.
That's what people always say about Paul Stanley. He's an innocent guy.
I have good Paul Stanley stories.
You do?
He had a very good man, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying he's a bad man, yeah. But I don't think people think of KISS as like, oh, those little innocent guys. Like, I don't mean in terms of crime. I just mean in terms of sex and drugs and stuff.
Sure.
And hey, we all wish we had been in the band KISS. I mean, it's later, many parts of my book are about how we were so not like a band like KISS.
Well, you do talk about that well in terms of forming your onstage identity. And here's these guys take it to the complete extreme with 7-inch, platform shoes and makeup and everything. And you guys, and especially at the time, the onstage identities of bands, especially coming out of Seattle, was much more stripped down and less theatrical. But at the same time, you still put on like an incredible show, and you in particular had like a very distinct style on stage. Can you talk about forming that? Do you remember taking any turns or the process of sort of knowing who you'd be on stage? Did you adopt any KISS-isms and then later reject them? Any sort of, tell us something embarrassing.
I did not start out as with the kind of like kinetic performance that I do now. I feel like I was shyer, a lot more, not even self-conscious, just I didn't move around as much as I do now or that I would start to do later in Sleater-Kinney. I mean, here is something embarrassing, I guess. You're trying, and I did, as a kid, I did perform a lot. I was pretty obsessed with Elvis, and I really did, I would put on performances for my grandparents using their canes as microphones, and I really liked Elvis's leg moves. So perhaps I'm just, this is totally for your benefit, that I'm just making this connection, but, you know, maybe my leg moves came from Elvis.
Yeah.
And
there's some of the, you know,
this?
Karate kind of.
Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah. when. So one of the we're going to fast forward a lot to when you guys first went on hiatus. I mean, you guys took a hiatus. And I think that what's fascinating about the book and about your life and your creative pursuits is how much you'll pivot from very different directions. And shortly after you guys went on hiatus, you were home, you were back in Washington, and you took a very different direction and you became the 2006 Humane Society Volunteer of the World, I mean of the year, for the state of Oregon, am I right? Or is it, yeah. And talk about that. Did you miss performing at that point? Did the hiatus seem permanent? What was going on when you go from touring through Europe with a band that's been called the best band in America, by the way, which Greil Marcus called you, to being at home in a much more sort of taking care of animals and being a volunteer and having that sense of sort of, you know, a position of serving?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, that so much of this book, sort of each section is, one of the themes is the idea of family or lack thereof and the ways we try to substitute for that lacking or loss. And in the final section, which you're talking about, I think instead of writing about, well, this is how I felt after Sleater-Kinney broke up, I wanted to sort of metaphorically describe in a pretty intense way, I guess, how I was trying to cobble together an idea of family. And it ended up, instead of being stabilizing or comforting, sort of became a locus of grief. But I will say that when I was volunteering for the Humane Society, which I did assiduously and very fervently after we broke up, I was relieved. I didn't want to be looked at. I wanted to be as anonymous and servile as possible. Like, I just felt like I was serving a greater good, and, you know, animals' needs are so simple. I love the writer Joy Williams so much, and she writes a lot about animals, and she has this quote about how, you know, so many things that have been harmed by human words are resolved in the silence of animals, and I felt that the whole time. I just dedicated myself to these tasks that I knew the boundaries. I knew there were walls there, and there were needs that were able to be met, and that the ritual of it, the simplicity, was very gratifying for me at a time where I didn't want to be identified as somebody, you know, in a band, because that had become so volatile and so heartbreaking. Mm. So, yeah.
So those years were healing.
Yeah. I mean, it was, yeah, I guess, it, yeah, 2006. So, yeah, I volunteered hundreds of hours. Mm-hmm. And I got a Volunteer of the Year award. And I mean, I did a lot. Also, I mean, when you go from, like, playing on stage to thousands of people to literally cleaning, like, sprayed from, like, some nervous, like, six-month-old puppy, and you're just hosing it down. I mean, that's healing.
Mm. I wondered if you could, I think as a last coda, I wondered if you could read that. I think it's sort of, it's a beautiful passage that sort of, I think, sums up a lot of what you've been talking about.
Long ago, I stopped focusing on performing for the sake of my family, but instead performed in spite of it, away from it, to get out. The bottomless urge I had to entertain as a child had sent me headstrong and hurling myself into rooms, hoping I'd arrive in time to delay or minimize the breakage. Cop, coach, clown, a one-girl Greek chorus there to protect, instruct, and delight. But there was no one I could really save but myself. That's what I mean when I say Slater-Kinney was my rescue and salvation. It was the first time I felt I could be vulnerable in my creativity, in which the emotional and psychic stakes were neither futile nor self-annihilating. That unlit firecracker I carried around inside me in my youth, eager to ignite it at the slightest provocation, to detonate my whole being and fill the room in a glowing spectacle, found a home in music. My restlessness and unease was matched by my fellow miscreants, bandmates, collaborators, and audiences alike, but more crucially, by a warmth and sustenance. In Slater-Kinney, each song, each album, built an infrastructure, fresh skeletons. These, at last, were steady bones. Now performing was no longer about trying to harness a cursory attention or to be a distraction. Slater-Kinney allowed me to perform both away from and into myself, and to leave and to return, forget and discover. Within the world of the band, there was a me and a not me, a fluctuation of selves that I could reinvent along the flight between perches. I could at last let go. For so long, I had seen the lacking I'd been handed as a deficit. My resulting anxiety and depression were ambient, a tedious lassoing of air. But with Slater-Kinney, I stopped attempting to contain or control the unknown. I could embrace the unnamed and the in-between. I could engage in an unapologetic obliteration of the sacred. Singularities had always been foreign to me, and where and who I came from was rife with dualities, a mesh of conflicted and diluted selves attempting to cohere, failing on account of an inarticulate denial. Fortunately, music granted me both an allowance of and a continual engagement with the ineffable. I also, for once, felt a part of something. The inexplicable is its own form of freedom. Belonging is not a form of restriction. We can't name the feeling, but we can sing along.
Carrie Brownstein.
Dave Eggers. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was musician, actress, and writer Carrie Brownstein, who appeared in 2015 to discuss her memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. She was joined in conversation by writer, editor, and publisher Dave Eggers. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamatuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.